Mr. Wagman, reel two. You were just telling me a few biographical details about your stepfather, Mr. Weston, who was in the Royal Norfolk Regiment. If you can repeat them, please.
Yes. His name was Leonard Weston, and he was, before the war, I think he was an architect and surveyor. And I don't recall the circumstances as to why he went into the war on operation, but he obviously must have got called out. And he became an officer almost straight away. And I remember as a child that he went out to South Africa for some little time, and then when he came back, he was with the Royal Norfolk Regiment on coastal defences along the coastline from Lincolnshire to Norfolk and Suffolk.
But you said he was the brother of the Weston brothers?
Yes, he was the brother of George Weston. I suppose you singing comedians, I suppose you would call them.
They sang the pop songs, didn't they?
Although they were called the Weston brothers, George and my stepfather were brothers, but the other one, I think, was a cousin.
And they sang the pop songs of the day, I think.
But they sang and very much, how can I explain it, used to sing with a sort of protracted type of us, we are the Weston brothers. I say, old man, have you heard this one? But very popular during the war and just after the war.
And you say your stepfather had musical talents himself?
Yes, he had this ability to just hear a tune and sit down at the piano and read it off. And I gather that my younger sister would probably be able to confirm this, that he composed some tunes during the war, some light music. Although I must admit I don't remember too much about that, but he certainly was very gifted music-wise.
Had he told you much about soldiering and the regiment?
No, I don't remember too much about him talking about his duties in the Royal Norfolk Regiment. And I think the thing that I remember more than anything is the shock of going from idea, call up medical and failing. And I think that must have in some way influenced me in deciding that, you know, I've got somehow or other I've got to get into the forces.
Now, coming back to the recruits training, were there any blacks people?
I don't remember that where there were any coloured people. There possibly were one or two, but it doesn't stick out in my memory.
When you said the NCOs had to knock the recruits into shape, what exactly did you mean by that?
They were doing their duty. They had to get us into some sort of disciplined fighting shape because there was a distinct possibility that they were going to end up in some wartime situation.
Did you ever feel you were treated unfairly in the training?
No, I don't think I can honestly say that. If I strayed from the natural path and I did something wrong, I got punished for it. I probably deserved it.
Why did you do your basic training in West Suffolk instead of Norfolk?
Yes, I'm quite sure why that was. Maybe they hadn't got the facilities of the Jenny Barracks at Mouse Hole. Or it may well have been that because National Service was very much on in 1951, they had to use other camps. The only time I ever went to the Tanny Barracks was for Mighty Mob.
And after your basic training, where did you go then?
Yes, after basic training, we were shipped out to Hong Kong. And attached to the Middlesex Regiment, who had just come back from Korea. And I was possibly with the Middlesex Regiment, I would reckon, for about 6 months before we were moved on again to Japan. And I think the reason for this is, well, whilst I was old enough to go to Korea, some of the recruits were not old enough.
So, you were attached to the Middlesex Regiment in Hong Kong in the summer of 1951, were you?
Yes, that's right.
What?
And that's where I did my machine gun training. And possibly that 6 months was most enjoyable for me because I was lucky enough to be playing cricket for the Army B team. And it was just myself who was a private in the Royal North Regiment and a captain in the Middlesex Regiment who kept wicket. And he used to look after me quite handsomely after the match.
Can you tell me more about your machine gun training in Hong Kong?
Yes. This was mainly carried out by the Middlesex machine gun instructors. And if my memory serves me right, the Middlesex Regiment has quite a reputation of being a machine gun regiment. And I distinctly remember going up and down these hills time and time again, and it gets quite hot out in Hong Kong, and you've got a tripod and all the gun itself, plus all the ammunition and all the other equipment. Quite extensive training, actually.
We haven't said what kind of a machine gun it was. We haven't said what kind of a machine gun this was.
Yes, the Vickers 303 water-cooled machine gun.
What were the main lessons you had to learn on the Vickers?
I think one of the main things was to learn all the stoppages. Because it was such a rapid machine gun, there were all kinds of things that could go wrong. And there were so many stoppages, and you had to be able to master these because there's no good starting and firing a machine gun and it stops and not knowing what to put it right. And very much the assembly of it and the changing of the barrels. When it's fired for a particularly long time, the barrels get almost sort of red hot, and after a period of time, they would have to be changed. There was quite a bit of mechanical things that you had to learn about the machine gun and its assembly. And its ability to fire on direct firing rounds with the aid of a sight. Direct sight.
What was life like for the soldier in Hong Kong in 1951?
Very enjoyable. Hong Kong, we were based in the New Territories, and Hong Kong wasn't all that far away. And I remember it as an enjoyable place to have leave. And I was a little bit fortunate. My mother had somebody that she knew over on the island, and I was able to go and visit them. And they used to take me to places that I wouldn't have been able to afford to go to as an ordinary swabby. And I remember going to the Hong Kong racecourse, which would have been well out of my range as a private soldier.
How did most soldiers spend their time in Hong Kong?
I think, as most soldiers or naval people do when they're in a foreign country, and they. They like a good time. They like to where the food was marvelous and quite cheap, and the alcohol, if I remember rightly, the famous one that we used to drink out there was called San Miguel Lager, and if you did a couple of hours, I think it was about sixpence a nip at the Navy Club in Hong Kong.
Was this rum?
Rum or whiskey or again, sixpence a nip.
What about associating with women in Hong Kong?
Yes, and there was obviously plenty of that, and if I remember right, the thing I do remember particularly, and I never could quite understand that particular, you used to have to buy tickets for a dance hostess, and it cost you whatever, I can't remember the exact amount, and you used to sort of have to buy these like raffle tickets, and then you had the girl sat at your table, and then if you wanted to dance with her, then you had to give her another ticket.
Did any more permanent liaisons arise from these?
I would imagine there were plenty of that. And from my recollections as well, And I'm sure it hasn't changed today, that quite a lot of them came home with Asian brides.
What was the attitude of the army towards that?
If I remember rightly, it was frowned on. And I think, if I remember rightly, also there was actually a sort of an age limit on marriage, but that may have applied perhaps to NCOs or officers.
So this was to marrying women from Hong Kong?
From, yes, Asian females.
But not to marriage itself, or was it to marriage generally?
No, as I didn't get involved with that, I didn't really take too much notice of that. But I certainly remember that there were some of the soldiers there, but not necessarily the soldiers and naval personnel who were married to Hong Kong girls.
Why did the army have this attitude?
I think, and this is only a personal opinion, is that maybe they thought that they didn't really fit into possibly the service life, and also when they got back home into our culture. But that's purely a personal feeling on that.
Is that a presumption of yours?
A presumption, yes.
Did you enjoy it in Hong Kong?
Yes, very much so. It was an early start in the morning, and the first parade was Salt Parade, and by midday you were laid down again and possibly go on duty again, say 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. It was terribly hot, and possibly I, because of my condition, I felt the heat. And I remember that it was nothing extraordinary in changing your uniform 3 times a day.
What were there any disturbances in Hong Kong or active service duties there?
Yes, my memories of that were we were based in the New Territories, and ours was very much a watching brief. They were watching us from China, and we were watching them. And we used to do border duties, and it was very much just a watching brief. But I do remember one particular time when I was on leave in Kowloon, and there was very much a communist element in Hong Kong at that time, where there were disturbances and riots, and work was somehow pushed down, and we were immediately ordered back into camp.
So you weren't called out to deal with them?
No.
What would happen on the border duties?
As far as I'm aware, I don't remember any instances where there were anything out of the ordinary happening on the border at that particular time.
Could you see the communist forces?
Not so. We could, and we had our binoculars. It was very much a watching brief. They were looking at us, and we were watching them.
What did they look like? From the soldierly point of view.
I'll tell you something that I do remember. I said we were got quite bored watching the other army fellow who was watching you, and they seemed to be smartly dressed and well turned out and strutting and marching about. But I remember one particular time when I was on the border patrol, and the women were in the paddy fields and sowing the rice or whatever they do. And I hadn't had my binoculars on her at the time, and then she suddenly sort of got up by that and went to the side of the field and lay down and had her baby. And a little while later, she went back into the paddy field and got on with her work that she was doing. And I never actually forgot it. She had a baby and then went back to work in the paddy field.
Were there other people helping her?
Other Chinese people around. I didn't actually see the... didn't want to see the birth or anything like that, but I never forgot it. And she had the baby and then got up and went back to work.
Did you see the baby?
No, I didn't see the baby, no. I saw what sort of wrapped up and sort of moving, but I can't honestly say that I actually saw the baby.
What were these troopship voyages like in those days? Troopship voyages?
Yes. I went out on, I think it was called the Empire Pride. And from my recollection, I believe it originally was some sort of German ship. And there was nothing really comfortable about this boat at all. And once we got past the Bay of Biscay, I made a point of getting up and sleeping on deck because it was hammocks over your eating area. And if you were sort of late getting up in the morning, you had to be careful where you put your foot. You could be putting your foot in someone's porridge as you got out of the hammock. And it seemed to be an eternal day of chores. Folding the hammocks, cleaning the mess area, cleaning the loos, swabbing the passageway down, and not a very comfortable journey.
This was about May 1951, was it?
This would be, yes.
How did you feel about going to the Korean War?
At the time, obviously quite excited, and after the training with the Middle South Regiment, we were lucky enough to go from Hong Kong on an aircraft carrier. And like me, I can't remember the name, but I do remember that whilst we were on an aircraft carrier, they treated us extremely well, and we were allowed to have Yamishu whilst we were on this journey to Sasebo at the base of Japan.
Did you go with a unit to Japan?
With the other intake who were going to Korea at that time, and they would be, as far as I know, they were all going off.
Were you following what was happening in the Korean War?
Not in great detail, if I remember rightly. And by the time the war and orphans were going out there in 1951, and most of the action had been by people who had been there before, and particularly the Grosses. And by the time we got out there, there was, although the war was still going on, it was position-wise, it was a bit of a stalemate.
Did you do anything in Japan before you went to Korea?
No. We went up to from Sasebo by train, and I have vivid memories of passing through Nagasaki, and even in 1951 you could still see the devastation of the atomic bomb. And then on to Kure, and we were there in a sort of holding barracks there, really waiting to see when we were going to be called over there. And I remember putting in an application to become an instructor at Haramura Battle Training Ground in Japan, because I thought that would be quite a nice little posting. That didn't work out. And it must have been, I gather afterwards, that there was a shortage of machine gunners. And so I wasn't in Kure for very long. I was shipped out.
What equipment did you take with you to Korea?
Virtually everything that your unit could carry, and obviously we must have taken our own because machine gun equipment, and also I believe there were quite a bit of mortar equipment.
Do you know approximately what date you arrived in Korea?
To be honest and say I'm a bit sketchy on that. I'm not quite sure what.
But we're talking about the summer of 51, are we?
Yes, that's right. It would be early summer of 51, and I remember actually getting to our position on 355 and marching up into position on the hill there, and with all our equipment, and Korean porters carrying a lot of the ammunition. And suddenly we got shelled, and the shells were nowhere near us, but to me, as a just arrived there, they seemed getting up to me, and I remember seeing these shells landing sort of all around us. And I remember turning around to somebody and saying, "What the bloody hell am I doing here?"